Welcome, everybody, for a special early session of the podcast. I have a flight today.
So. You feeling groggy?
It's 10 a.m., which I'd never see. I wake up at like noon.
Heading back to the East Coast for your sister's wedding.
Yes, yes. I have some things.
Yeah, fire away.
Our friend came to visit us. We hung out with him. Friend of the podcast. He's sponsored it before. Justin, who runs Kettle and Fire. But I was reminded of a story that I kind of told you, but didn't really tell the audience, is that he invited me with a group of his friends to speak at his study group, or a group of friends who came together just to learn things, and they were interested in persuasion. And
yeah, he's got a group of successful CEO friends, yeah. Right? They all run multi-million-dollar businesses.
I don't know if all of them, but they're doing well.
And they bring you in as the expert on persuasion to help them in their business negotiations.
Well, other Justin invites me and says, "Hey, do you want to come on? Like, you know, you got this. We'd love to have you." I said, "Sure." And so I came in, and it's funny because I studied for years Tony Robbins's methodology, which I think is like the most amazing persuasion methodology there is. Mm-hmm. It's what he uses on audience members. If you have ever seen his documentary, to get someone to basically break down and change their views in probably a 15 to 45 minute conversation.
Yeah, people don't realize he just has a formula, basically. Yeah. He's a genius in how he implements it, but he uses the same 7 steps every time you've ever seen him talk to someone about losing weight, mm-hmm. not committing suicide, depression, failing in business. He runs them through the exact same framework, and the only he changes is the exact word he uses at each step.
And this, it's because there's different motivators for different people. So he's finding out their particular motivators.
Right, but it's always, there's a step in there about finding which of the 6 core needs
is their biggest leverage.
Their biggest one. Yeah. And normally people have 2 biggest ones. And it's this every single intervention, there's a step where he does that. Like it's much more formulaic than it seems. When you first watch Tony Robbins, it just seems like sorcery.
Riffing, yeah.
So you know that. You studied it for years. You implemented it on coaching clients.
And we've seen incredible things. And you had someone who had been struggling with weight loss.
Yeah, she lost 150 pounds.
It was like stuff that people can't change and want to change. It's incredible. So mm-hmm. for persuasion, this is just the nuclear bomb. And I totally forgot about that. So I was not that it was like this high pressure thing, but I was on the Zoom call. And the way that I think about persuasion now, because I haven't studied that, is my basic tenets as I was thinking about them before the call are, remember that you don't need anything from anyone. So anytime you get upset that someone isn't giving you the deal or the partnership or the whatever, just relax, because it wasn't going to make your life more meaningfully happy.
Yeah, that's Russell Brand's one of his biggest takeaways from Enlightenment that he talks about on the Logan Paul podcast, right?
And again, these are, and I would caveat these with, these make sense once you've achieved middle class or upper middle class. Like if you are starving and you think you need things from people like a job, or food, or shelter, I think that totally makes sense.
Right.
This is up the hierarchy of needs.
Makes sense when you're talking to a room of multi-million-dollar
CEOs. In my opinion, it makes total sense for them. And I caveated all this in that. So yeah, that's one thing. Another thing that I have is, if I do feel like I need something, try to make sure that it's never particular to an individual. Now, there's always cases where it's like you want your dad to stop a bad habit, or you mm-hmm. want your spouse to do something. But barring those, you don't need this particular company to purchase yours, and you don't need this particular client to sign up. Like, always address persuasion on the aggregate level.
Sure. You feel that way even if you're an employee. If you're trying to get a raise, one of the best ways to do it is go get a higher paying offer. And then return to your employer and say, "Hey, I got an offer for 20% more. Mm-hmm. Do you want to match it?"
Yes. Anytime you need one individual to do something, you're desperate. But if you're like, "Look, I don't need all the bosses in the world to give me a raise. I just need a boss to give me a raise." Mm-hmm. And so then you go find other bosses that are more amenable to that raise. So anyway, I go into this thing, hang out on my bed, my hair's disheveled, and I show up and I'm like, the point, persuasion is really just don't try and and realize that no one has anything to give you and you can't change. And we saw him this weekend. I was like, "Dude, they did not like that." He's like, "Yeah." and I knew it on the call. They really were not into it. And we've talked about this in the past. I'm not saying that I'm enlightened, but I can tell you that as someone who knows both the highly effective way to change people's particular minds and these mindsets, these ones have made me more comfortable and more happy. They haven't resulted necessarily in more sales, but like, I realize that I don't want necessarily the more sales or need the more sales, or if the struggle to get more sales is just not worth it. And it is the least viral message.
Yeah.
Because if you look at viral messages, they have planes and abs and beautiful
things. Well, weirdly enough, this is the number one piece of negotiating advice that I got when I was focused on doing well in business from a guy who was focused on doing well in business, which is the person who needs the other person the least will win the negotiation 9 times out of 10. So it's not even off the mark if just your goal is business success to say, step back from being so needy, because the more attached you are to a particular outcome or a particular person, the more you will get screwed in a negotiation.
But the follow-up question from these guys, and it always is, but let's say that I...
I'm just saying, even forget enlightenment.
Yeah.
This is just what I would tell a Wharton business student who asked me, what's the number one piece of advice in negotiation? Whatever you're going in for, just need it less than the other person. You will subconsciously and automatically negotiate better.
And well, and the way that you need it less is you think about other options. You think about having gotten what you wanted in the past. Yeah. And you think about, has that significantly, like, the what was the last thing I needed to have? And how much happier am I now that I have gotten it?
Well, that's my number one answer to the follow-up. So the follow-up, well, how do I need it less? If you're looking for a job, just apply to 30. I applied to 120 jobs out of undergrad. And I was not stressing ever in an interview. Because I just like, I'm going to get a bunch of these. And I'm going to have 10 to choose from. And kids who had a dream company and applied to 3 companies, devastating when they don't get a callback interview. And God forbid they don't get any of the 3, they're screwed. So it's like, yeah, even if your goal is to be outcome oriented, this is still actually the best way. Maybe not for persuasion, because that includes friend relationships and stuff, but for business and negotiating, it's like, yeah, care less, get options. This actually is the most effective.
But yes,
if they want to get the one. They want to get the one. They want to go, how do I use covert hypnosis to get the one person to do what I want? That's what they want to know.
And it was just, I was reflecting on it, and it's, I wasn't invited. I'm friends with Justin, so he thought of me, but he didn't think of me necessarily, and I'm not saying that I am. He didn't invite me because I'm super happy and well-adjusted. He invited me because I have 4.5 million subscribers and have indicators of success in this field. Like, that's why he thought of me.
Sure.
And I don't blame him at all for that. It's just interesting that, like, we wouldn't ask the happiest person we know, how do I be more persuasive? Because the reason that we want to be persuasive is to get what we want, which is to be happy. So, like, why not just go to the end of the rainbow and find that person who has figured it out and then say, oh, tell me about how persuasion relates to your life and how relationships fit into your life and how business fits into your life.
Well, I think there's a mindset that that person is a sucker if they don't have the external. I mean, yeah. I seriously think you see a guy... And their relationship, the person they're with is not particularly attractive. They don't have a ton of money. They have a small house. And you're like, how's it going for you? And every time you see them, like, it's amazing, fantastic. Oh, my God, my life's a dream. You don't think, oh, my God, this person is so enviable. You think, this guy's a sucker. And he just learned to settle for mediocrity.
Yeah.
And so I think we don't take people at their word. Even when a billionaire, even if every billionaire in the world said, as soon as I got over $100 million, crippling depression hit me and I've never shook it since.
Yeah.
People would still pursue $100 million. Yeah. Like, we don't even take people at their word for what makes them unhappy. Mm-hmm. We just chase the external, the indicators of success.
If every billionaire came out and said, I'm an addict, I can't help it, it doesn't feel good, that would turn very few people off.
Harvard Business School would get the exact same amount of applicants.
Or let's
investment
say
investment banking would get the exact same.
They're not necessarily trying to be billionaires, but if you could lower that number to $5 million or whatever, like that investment banking puts you into that.
No, realm. I'm saying even if every person who had $50 million came out and said, as soon as I hit that mark, I had crippling depression, people would still aim for $48 million. You know? Like, they'd be like, oh, I'll just get as close as I can. Yeah. And then I'll stop.
I think they'd shoot over it even. But I guess, and to be fair, people are right to not take people at their word for self-reported happiness. I think that's wise. Like, you have to look not just what someone says, how they seem to behave, the emotions that they seem to experience, and I not just in a short period. Like, you can turn off the sadness and become a traumatized victim of your past and, like, never feel sad.
Yeah, I think it's over time. I don't know. I have a friend. He's just always happy, and he rolls with the punches. And after 10 years of seeing him roll with various punches, I finally believe him. Like, you know, I really think this isn't an act.
Yeah. Yes, it takes time, and that's the fair point. But the only thing that really occurred to me, I was like, I snuck my way in here with the 4.5 million subscribers, gave a message that was not well received, and I don't blame him at all because I wasn't what they wanted, won't be invited back and won't be heeded or listened to in that regard. And if I'd come in and, like, given them the Tony Robbins system and taught them to implement it, I might have people spending an hour a week working on remembering the Tony Robbins thing, which is valuable. If you are certain that you know your goal and you're not going to give up on it. And this is what's going to make you happy, is to influence this other individual. Mm-hmm. So yeah, just a reminder to myself that the things that I want are not the most viral. They don't always connect with me. Like, I'm sure that I've just walked into other examples, been on the flip side of this, where I was seeking a particular outcome. Somebody showed up and was like, hey, how about you just be happy? I was like, fuck you. I have an idea of how this is supposed to go.
Sure.
Lots of random things that I could talk about. Do you have any?
Yeah, I mean, I watched Dominion. I don't know if you want to talk about that.
Oh, wow. Yeah, we could do that.
So I watched Dominion. It is a documentary about the factory farming industry in Australia. The imagery is intense. I definitely recommend it, because as much as you can talk about, oh yeah, I know what goes on in factory farms, or I get a sense that it's not, you know, they don't treat the animals that nice. When you see it, it creates a very different emotional reaction. And I think you just don't necessarily imagine it as brutally as it is, if that makes sense. Like, you don't get the screams and stuff like that. And I know that's going to make people not want to watch it, but I actually think a very fair request is, you don't have to change any of your habits, but if you are going to eat meat that is cultivated in this way, you should be willing to spend 20 minutes just seeing how it's made. And I think if you aren't willing to do that, I don't know, it's a bit cowardly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just interesting, because you also hear a little bit of propaganda, like pigs are peacefully killed in carbon dioxide, and then you watch it and they just scream because they're suffocating to death.
Yeah.
Like, it's the marketing when it's in text is a little bit different than when you watch it and you see it. You go, oh yeah, when you kill something with carbon dioxide so that it passes out. In order to pass out, it has to feel deprived of oxygen. So it acts exactly like if you smothered it with a pillow.
Yeah,
it's brutally trying to figure out how to escape and get air. So it's very, I don't know, it's good in the sense that it just makes you really concretely aware of what's happening.
Has it made it easier for you to say, I know you were not eating meat. Has it made it easier? Because part of the reason I know you did it was to just for a refresher on the why of.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. It's definitely made it easier. But I actually had more higher level takeaways. So like, one, if you're gonna eat cows, if you're gonna eat pigs, I think it's fair to just say, hey, just watch this for 10 minutes. And if you don't want to, you're kind of a coward. But the second thing is, it makes you realize how atrocities occur. Mm-hmm. You just keep it out of eyesight.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we always talk about the Holocaust and the Nazis and the atrocities of World War II. I bet most Germans had no idea what was happening in the concentration camps. If they even knew they existed, they're just like, oh yeah, like they take the Jews to these places and they go to these camps and I don't know, you just never see them again. And you go, oh yeah, this is how atrocities occur. You just do it out of eyesight, and then you tell people it's not a big deal.
And people have a vested interest. People's minds work for them on a subconscious level. And so take a German. Like, they might have imagined that what was happening in those camps wasn't nice, but their mind does them the very personal favor of not thinking deeply about it. You know, like, it doesn't conjure up those images on their behalf so that they may continue their life in relative comfort.
Yeah, and just use language that's like peacefully killing them with carbon dioxide. Yeah. It's a work camp, you know? Yeah, oh, what happened to my Jewish neighbor? Like, I actually like that person. Don't worry. They're at a work camp.
Yeah.
And so you recognize how easy it is for an atrocity to occur. But the other thing is you see the workers at some of these places, and they have no problem beating animals, tasing animals. Like, you watch them and you go, oh, these people seem like sadists. But for me, the takeaway wasn't, oh, these people were born sadists. It's that it's extremely easy to dehumanize anything if you start with someone when they're a child. It makes it to me a little bit clearer how slavery exists. Because if you took an animal and just took a kid randomly who had never seen them treated poorly and you start treating like this and they were screaming, most kids would go, stop, this is mean, like, the pig doesn't want this, mm-hmm. you shouldn't be doing this. But when that kid has that reaction, you have all the adults around them go, no, 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 this is fine. This isn't a big deal. Those scrims don't count. This pig doesn't count. Its feelings don't count.
And I also think that kid that you're imagining, that's a kid born in the 21st century who has never been on a hunt. You know what I mean? Like, kids that...
No, I'm talking about the kids of farmers who become farmers, who end up... And I'm not saying all farmers are bad, but the people in these videos...
Are you describing a state of nature where kids have a problem with screams? Because I'm not even sure that they flip one way or the other. I'm like, whatever you're acculturated into becomes that state of nature, is I guess what I'm saying. Because it's, imagine any 3-year-old would have seen corpses of animals and been near blood. And
yeah, this is what I'm saying, is if you just start from a child and mm-hmm. you just say slavery makes total sense, beating that person is fine, they're not a person. It's like, oh yeah, you just start at a young age and you just separate. You say, yeah, we treat people well, but this doesn't count as a person.
Yeah.
And then when you come in from the outside, you go, this person's a sadist. They have no problem beating a black slave. Or this person's a sadist. They have no problem beating a cow. It's like, no, this could happen to almost anyone if you just start at age 0.
Yeah.
Dehumanizing the other, whether the other is Jew, black, cow.
Well, there's a flip side to this, just so we're not romanticizing the state of nature, which is you have to humanize for kids. Like, I think there's also a tendency in children to steal, hit, hurt, and you have to be like, no, we don't do that. They're like us. And so you do carve out these two camps. And I think you have to actually teach, to a degree, I think you have to teach the violence and the restraint to kids. I don't know that kids are like particularly moral agents and deeply disturbed by screams.
I don't know. Don't have a kid.
But I do see what you're saying.
I imagine that they actually... I wonder if a kid starts with empathy. If you just show a kid someone being tortured, if they get uncomfortable.
I mean, I don't know, but I've seen pictures of like 3-year-olds next to screaming 1-year-olds, and they're just unperturbed. You know, like their brother is like telling the world something is killing me, and they're just like eating their Cheerios. They seem like less disturbed by the shrieks of other children, at least, than even adults do. So,
I don't know, because you also see those really sensitive kids. Mm-hmm. who get really upset if someone's like mean to an animal.
I think that they have, for instance, there's just no kid that has been raised in a vacuum. Like that kid was not raised in the savannah with his dad lugging back the corpse of a goat and carving it up and feeding him a piece. So I guess there is no state of nature is what I'm saying. There is no nice kid or mean kid. It's like, as soon as you're born into a world, you're surrounded by a cultural thing that tells you what is right and wrong.
Yeah. Well, I guess the takeaway for me is like, people are going to watch Dominion and they're going to think that the farmers are evil.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, this farmer's not evil. This farmer was taught from age 0 sure. that this is totally cool, encouraged. Doesn't count as being cruel. Because you're going to see adults like just for fun hurting animals, mm-hmm. like doing things outside of the process, even of factory farming, just because they have a taser and it makes them feel powerful or they think it's funny.
Sure.
But I don't think that person was born with a brain defect. I don't think that person was born cruel.
The way that I play Grand Theft Auto is like an absolute monster. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, yeah.
And I'm totally under the impression, and still am, and would defend and fight for, that they don't count. You know, like that the creatures and the beings, whatever, in that go, no! Like, yeah, yeah. They don't count. So the most horrible thing that you can do is just, it's a goof. And I think that, yeah, there's that same thing can occur. Different skin colors, different species, your sister, your brother, like depending on who doesn't count.
Well, yeah, because weirdly enough, I think the most common outcome of watching Dominion would be to demonize the people that you watch in the video and then not stop eating meat.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I think most people would do. And I'm saying I feel like that's the opposite takeaway, mm-hmm. which is to understand that even those people look like they're doing things that are cruel, they have been completely desensitized to it for their entire lifetime, probably. And also, you should stop giving them money by eating their products.
Yeah.
So that was my takeaway from watching it. And I think it's good. It's good to watch if you're vegan or if you're not. And if you can watch the whole thing and then keep eating meat, at least you know what's going on.
Sure.
You know, I think that's a more honest way to go about eating meat.
Yeah, no, I think that makes a ton of sense. The one thing we spoke about, that tribe in Africa last week, what that put into my mind is that there's not one. I am a moral relativist, and I think morality is dependent upon your circumstances. And so we're speaking to who we imagine is a fairly similar podcast audience. Not that you wake up at 10 a.m. like I do, but that you will not starve.
Yeah, you're not starving.
Yeah, and you will not... suffer other than inconvenience and a lack of a tasty pleasure that you like, but
yeah, no, or maybe a rebudgeting. It's like, oh, yeah. This is,
or it's a bit more expensive.
It's more expensive to eat fish, so you have to make your coffee at home instead of going to Starbucks.
Yeah, or something. And that you might have to make purchases in other places. That that's who we're imagining speaking to. But I am there is a level at which I go, life requires causing suffering for every being, with the possible exception of plants.
Yeah, I don't. I think that there's not a lot of people listening to this who are probably in that point, though,
yeah,
where they literally have to, or they'll die, take the lowest quality meat they can find.
Yeah.
I was going to say afford, but it's more like just that exists in their world.
Well, there's also, and I think there's this gray zone of like, you have bigger fish to fry than to watch Dominion and care. Like, I would, and I agree, like, I want you to watch Dominion. I want you to care. I think it's the right thing for you, even if you're low, say, like, lower class American, or not lower class, lower income American. But yeah, there's like, I get that you're not carving out time to listen to the Charlie and Ben podcast and and watch Dominion. Though it would be great if
I guess what I'm saying is if you're listening to this, then you are carving out time to listen to podcasts. So if you're carving out time to listen to podcasts, the documentary is 2 hours long, but you actually... that I think from minute 4 to 24 covers pigs and cows. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to watch the section on eating goats, eating rabbits, eating dogs, eating fish. I trust that just...
Do you want to mention your eating fish takeaway? Because we eat fish. Did you have any...
It's just a blip. I didn't watch... It's not like Seaspiracy. It's just a small part of the documentary. So I watched the whole thing, but they're not really focused on it.
I've felt this way about a lot of the documentaries that I watch on this stuff. They don't give you strong, like, they'll give you arguments for like Dolphin Cove or Blackfish, but I'm just like, okay, I'm talking about salmon or that kind of stuff to see. And oftentimes it's the destruction of the oceans is what they reference. But then I go, okay, what about like not wild caught salmon? And I haven't yet personally come across a compelling reason or thing to stop. So if you guys know,
well, they talk about like. Yeah, it's just tough to know what's going on in the brain of a fish because it's quite small relative to like the brain of a cow. So they talk about, oh, when they catch these fish, sometimes they'll put them into places where there's not a lot of space. Mm. It's like, well, I don't know. How much does a fish mind that? The grass grows right on top of each other. Does every blade of grass mind? Mm-hmm. I watched the fish part.
Or the ants. The ants are crawling all over each other, man.
Yeah. The only part I skipped was dog. I was like, I'm 100% positive I won't watch dog.
Don't worry. So this is...
I watched the whole thing. It's very long. Yeah. but really, cows and pigs are only minute 4 to 24 or something.
Yeah. I think we got bugs safely. Can eat them for just about ever.
I don't know. Unless the movie The Ants Life is true. This is the thing. We were like, this is why cows... It's like, okay, a cow, a dog... a pig, these things kind of emote like we emote, so it's easier for us to understand, and their brains are similar sizes, so it's easier for us to intellectually comprehend that they probably feel pain in the same way we do and feel suffering in the same way we do. And then there's other things like trees, which we just assume don't because they're anatomically completely different. Then there's mollusks, then there's shrimp, then there's salmon, then there's... And so it's like, I don't actually have any concept for how those things exist. It's tough to empathize with a mollusk, to understand what it would be like to only be a piece of muscle. You know what I mean? So that's why I kind of draw the line at like, okay, well, I'm not even going to tell people not to eat chickens. Like, I have stopped eating chicken, but my main thing is just pigs and cows, factory farmed pigs and cows. That seems so close to home.
Yeah. Any other takeaways?
Not from that. No.
Cool. What else do we have? I have a lot of random stuff. So Jon Stewart came on Stephen Colbert, and it was interesting. So one thing that I haven't mentioned because I have nothing to add to the discussion, Brett Weinstein has been talking about this, the lab leak hypothesis, which I think if you're on YouTube, you probably have heard or seen before, the idea that COVID was generated by studies in the Wuhan lab. Mm. Not nefariously leaked, but the idea that they were studying coronaviruses there, and allegedly they had bats, allegedly, at the lab, and that one got out, as contagious viruses tend to do.
Sorry, is it that a scientist got sick or just that a bat got out?
That a virus somehow jumped to a person, that person went home, you know, or that they didn't do safety protocols in the right way and they were around a virus and brought it back on an article of clothing that went to a family member, something of that nature. I don't know exactly how, but this was a like blockable and potentially bannable. I don't know if it was bannable on YouTube. It was COVID misinformation. Donald Trump didn't describe it very well, but got in a lot of heat for saying it, and it was not allowed to be spoken. And the amorphous nature of corporations and large news channels makes it impossible to hold anyone accountable for it. You know what I mean? Like, there's nobody who's...
Well, aren't people still adamant that it didn't happen?
It, at least at this point on YouTube, and I have no way of checking, to be clear. I have zero capability of learning. I can only tell you, like, say which way the wind is blowing. The wind is, on YouTube, blowing in the other direction. That
people,
is,
people now largely think it was a lab leak.
It is. There is an increased space and attention, and you will not be blocked as quickly on YouTube. Like, you won't have your video necessarily removed for saying it.
Got it.
And the point is not, so I won't opine on whether it's true or not, because I have no way of checking. But the, we, you know, I won't beat this up. We just talk about it to death. Who is going to be doing the censoring, and how will they decide? You know, it's like, the WHO says no today, and they said yes yesterday, and tomorrow they say maybe. Like, whatever they say is what is allowed to be heard. It's a very corrupt system that we have.
Just trust in Big Brother, dude.
Yeah, yeah. Just
relax. Trust in Big Brother. They have your back.
Yeah. So I mean,
never misinform you for their own benefit.
If you want to watch the lab leak hypothesis, there's another interesting talk on Brett Weinstein's podcast with a guy, and again, I have no way of checking, but it's just an interesting idea. Who says that there's this medicine, ivermectin, that is extremely useful in treating COVID, and he's been using it for a long time, and they will not let you really on YouTube. He had to, like, this is for the censors. We are, you know, they had to do this whole thing, and they did take the video down, and they got it reinstated. That this is a very effective treatment against COVID, and the way that they've been treating it is ineffective. The antivirals that they're using after day 10 don't make any sense because the viral load is dropped off by day 10. You're dealing with an inflammation disease, all this kind of stuff that I go, who knows? I'm not
sure.
Yeah,
could just be making it up.
This guy could just be making everything up. But it's just, how do you know which scientists to trust? Like, oh, you trust scientific consensus? Oh, that has a wonderful history over the course, you know, like at any given time and any given subject about of being correct, especially with completely novel phenomena. It is, it's just funny. Like, I go, yeah, I guess I will have no opinion, but if I was making the rules, I think I'd have to recognize that and lay off the screening of what people say, because I have no idea of knowing what is right in these fields.
Well, that's the tough part. This consensus, scientific consensus, is probably right most of the time.
Over time.
Yeah, they're just occasionally they get things wrong, like laughing at germ theory or laughing at the fact that the sun is in the middle of the universe or the solar system. Yeah. Like, so it's like, oh yeah, well, you're right most of the time, but sometimes someone tells you should wash your hands because there are these things called germs you've never heard of, and everyone just laughs at him and says he's an idiot.
Yeah.
You go, we got that one wrong.
Yeah. So at any given point, yeah, that you might be wrong, and if you're thinking that you need to censor for people's best benefit, be very cautious with that thought.
You want to talk about the German scientist?
Oh yeah, this was the other one. So John Stewart is doing. So John Stewart comes on. The reason is that he is. He very comically just says that this obviously came out of a lab in a way that is, you know, it's got the same name as the virus, and it's funny and it persuasive in its funniness, but not maybe it shouldn't be. He at one point is doing an impression of the Chinese scientists. About, you know, where it came from, as they're like making up lies and saying where it came from. He's like, he goes, maybe a bat kissed a pangolin. And I think he's doing a German or accent. And it's like, what is this? What, like, why are you doing it? Wait, it's just such a strange world that we've all sort of understood that we lived in, where if he were to do a stereotypical Asian accent of any kind, huge problems for him and his life. If he does a stereotypical German accent, places it on a Chinese scientist, no problems. Mm-hmm. It's just like, this is ridiculous. Not that I want there to be a problem for a German accent, but what has happened here? Like, like these rules. And I was reminded of, we went to the gym. As soon as the mask order came off in California, everyone in the gym had their mask off.
Mm-hmm.
And I remembered walking around the gym, like keeping my mask off because I was concerned, because I was like looking at other people. I was like, they're probably looking at me. They're probably feeling a certain way. And it was made evident yesterday is like every one of these people is fed up with this shit. All these people that I've just seen around did not want to have it on. Didn't like as soon as they were given license to take it off. No question.
That's what was interesting to me is it seems like there's this discord online of COVID now that we have the vaccines in the US. How serious is it? How serious is it not? And it feels like there's two sides arguing. But at least when I look around in my life, as soon as you were, hey, masks are voluntary now. If you feel unsafe, you can wear an N95 mask as much as you want and it will protect you. But you don't have to wear a mask if you don't want to. 100% of people stopped wearing masks. Yeah. And so I'm just curious, like, where are the people from the online Discord? And I think most people are just not weighing in at all. And so you can get the sense that there's two equal sides for any issue, whether it's a cancellation or a political issue or whatever, because they're both just as loud on the internet. But if you were to actually talk to people in real life, you might find that actually it's just 5% of the population
that actually has an opinion. 95% are just like, yeah, I didn't even notice that he was doing an accent of any kind and I don't care
right
of which one it was and I didn't find it offensive. But yeah, that we have adopted social norms to cater to the argument that the fringes have been having about whether you can do when you are doing an impression of a nondescript Chinese person, if it is okay to do a nondescript Chinese accent. Like, and the other idea being that it would be, which is just a strange idea, that it's somehow insulting to, it can be insulting if you're implying that someone is stupid for not speaking perfect English.
Well,
but this is how people sound.
This is the thing I think is funny. It's like you can do an impression of an individual that's spot on perfect and upset people. So you can have somebody and that person, they're a certain race or they have a certain way that they speak or certain mannerisms, and you do an exact side-by-side impression of that person and you will be accused of being homophobic or racist or whatever it might be because of the fact that you've done that impression. Yeah. I just think that's really strange.
It wasn't a highlighted moment of his interaction with Colbert, but I was just going like, what is this?
Well, he knows. You know, he knows how to do the dance so that he can get his point across without getting the cancel culture up on him.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's just silly. And I was like, who's enforcing this? You know, Colbert's audience probably largely is on that, in that 2.5% that would tremendously care. So perhaps he read the audience right. But yeah, don't need to go too deep onto that. Here was a question that I had. So there is a critical race theory sweeping the nation, you know, it's everywhere. It's in education, all that kind of stuff. Several states are taking steps that have like conservative governors to ban it, to ban it in the education system. And I don't know. I was like, man, what would I do as a governor? Like, you want to represent the people, and I guess, but also you're expected to do what you think is best for them. But
when you're representing the people, are you representing your state or the country or?
I think your state. I think your state.
So what if your state, what if you took a vote and your state is 60-40 against gay marriage?
Well, I think what you're supposed to do is as your term in governor, you're supposed to do what you think is best for the people in your state and then get voted out if in your next term, if that doesn't correspond with what I think that's actually like the structure of it.
Got it. So you don't feel like they're beholden to polls.
I think if everyone were clamoring for the Iraq war, for instance, and you're like, I'm certain there's no WMDs there. I think the right thing to do ethically in the democratic system is to vote no. Or yes, if you think that it's the right thing to do and everyone's against it, and then get voted out of office ASAP, I think. But in any event, it was just interesting because the fight indicates that, like you mentioned earlier, like kids just believe whatever the heck you tell them. Like whatever story you tell kids, people have started to recognize this very clearly. And this was happening all along, right? There's always indoctrination going on in schools. And this is not the first idea that people have been like, oh, what if we got this into their heads really young? But it's, I guess, become, I don't know if it was always, there was always this tight of a fight over it, or maybe it started to happen post-World War II with less concrete enemies that we could all agree upon. But yeah, people recognize like, oh, if you control the public education curriculum, it is an investment in just controlling the future. Like, you have to wait 30-ish sure. years, but you just have a nation of people that will behave in semi-predictable ways based on what you've told them. And that could be, they could all be very patriotic, or they could all be, and I don't mean that as a good or a bad thing. It's just scary.
You just hear it 1,000 times growing up. You think it's true.
Yeah. And you've got these people fighting over, clearly not agreeing over the story of the past, and they're going to tell it to kids, and kids wouldn't even have an idea to doubt it. They wouldn't even know that there was disagreement over the past. I remember the first time that I encountered people's history of the United States, and I heard just not the right story of the United States, but just a different story. I was like, oh, damn. I didn't know there was an alternative interpretation. Or that
we're not the good guys.
Canon. Yeah, that it was, and then we took half of Mexico for nothing? Like, that's just a segment of America that I've really not even heard discussed outside of Howard's.
No, and obviously some people do think something other than what they were told. You know, we have atheists from religious families, but I think for people who are listening here sitting, oh no, I'm atheist. Oh no, I'm agnostic. That's not true. People can think critically. Just think about what a small part of the country is atheist and agnostic. Compare it to how strongly you feel like the atheist arguments are clearly the best, and that's what you're going to get for any issue. Because I feel like most atheists are like, oh yeah, obviously it's so dumb that you would ever believe in a religious book. And I shook free of my religious upbringing. So clearly we all can. It's like, well, clearly we all can't, because a very small part of the population is atheist. So.
Yeah. No, for sure. I just have a bunch of random things if you want me to keep going.
No, go for it.
I read a study that was, it was just a Reddit thing and I clicked it. It said, I might get the phrasing wrong. Study finds BLM protests were overwhelmingly peaceful. And then I clicked the study and it was a short thing and it had numbers in it. You know, we studied 7,000 incidents and this in a 7,435 incidents, yada, yada, yada. But I found it was like, if I was interested in the idea of, are these peaceful? That's first off, what does that mean? In my mind, it means, were these events peaceful in comparison to similar events controlled for scale? But also then let's just talk in the absolute number, meaning like, okay, let's look at like the Rodney King riots and compare them to this. Let's compare them to Martin Luther King's peace walks or whatever he did, the walk to Selma or all that kind of stuff. And instead what was done is they broke like different gatherings up and called them like, I think, a unit of one, and then said this one was peaceful, this one was peaceful, this one was peaceful, and then the Santa Monica one was not. And they concluded that 97% of it was peaceful, which is like, this is not useful. This is not useful information. And we like, you can come up with a million things, but World War II was mostly peaceful. Like most of the day in most places, it was peaceful. Mm-hmm. It's just, so like 99% of the time, World War II was very peaceful. Only people were only dying on 1% of the occasions. Like that is just such an unuseful way to formulate the backbone of that sentence. And then I was clicking around and went to the authors, and they're, one of them has a book on activism coming out. And it's just, and it was a Harvard study. And I was like, man, I still have this that I can't shake, this institutional deference. Mm-hmm. When I see Harvard and a number, it puts something in my brain that is different than the guy down the hall making a claim.
Yeah. Well, they teach this in statistics, or at least they did where I went to college, that you can basically abuse statistics to make any point you want.
And they might not be wrong. Like there is a study that is, I think, compelling and interesting, which is how, like I said, how does this compare to similar events, both on scale? And I'd also want to know the absolute, because it's one thing to say, oh, like the Rodney King riots were more violent, more damage was done, more people were hurt, more people died. But also then you want to look nationwide and say, okay, on a scale level, it was less, but absolute, there was more. That to me is an interesting, were they peaceful, weren't they peaceful? But they just, to me, didn't even engage with the central question. And in myself, the most disappointing thing was when I saw Harvard, I just felt something. I felt, I should click this. Like this could be interesting. This could tell me something. And I was like, oh no, this, I don't know if these institutions ever were worth extra deference, but I just really, I wish I would get it through my head that that they no longer to me are. And if you went to Harvard, that's not a diss on you. That's a diss on the presumed authority that I give without any other data to Harvard or New York Times or Business Insider, or, you know, I don't give, and I'm purposely excluding Fox News and Cato Institute, because I never gave them any cred, because that was the family that I was raised in. But yeah, I have one other thing, unless you want to hop in.
No, I'm good.
My charisma is not good anymore.
What makes you say that?
So I went out to the, this isn't the only thing, but the spa just opened back up.
Uh-huh.
And I went in and they're like, hey, how are you guys? And they know us because we go a lot and we've been friendly in the past. And I felt myself torn between what I felt at the beginning of my charisma journey, which is my, I think, natural proclivity towards introversion,
mm-hmm.
and a complete and total understanding of what it would take to make this a special interaction.
Yeah.
And I have am just
Wait, what was the other side? So you said I felt two things.
Oh, no, it was my natural introversion and the understanding of exactly what I could do.
Oh, got it.
To make this like an interaction where they really liked me and handed me a bunch of free guest passes and like high-fived me and hugged it out. Like,
you're good, dude. I already have a bunch of free guest passes.
I know. Well, this is what I'm doing is I'm just like, I am consistently, even though I know what to do,
mm-hmm.
I am choosing introversion. I'm choosing it all the time, everywhere I go. And I don't think that's a problem necessarily, but it does as I go and I'm thinking about like what content to make. I am increasingly on the side of understanding charisma as a study that I did back in the day.
Mm.
And there was a time when it was like, I had new stories. I was like, that reminds me of this thing that happened this week. You know, I came into the situation and I handled it this way. And here's just an added color that I've learned this week. And, I'm not inspired to change. I don't want to. I feel like I've done that journey and I've gotten to our first conversation. Like, I don't feel that there's more for me to necessarily get out of it. And I like being introverted and I'm not rude to these people at all. Like, they're more happy to see us, I think, than most other people. And I am polite and kind of friendly, but yeah, I don't have the same bug that we had where we had to crack everything. And I'm, as you're making the videos now, I'm curious if you find yourself saying things that you already know or making new discoveries that from your life that you are including in the videos.
No, it's almost all stuff that I already know. I mean, the other tough thing though is like, so I started trying to study charisma at age 19, 14 years ago. I mean, there's to some extent, it's like how much more novel stuff could I find? Like I could find a nuance on it. You know what I mean? I could find a new wrinkle to something we've already said, but I do feel like most of the discoveries come early into a exploration of a topic. So like when I was first studying charisma, it was mind blowing that having an argument was bad or that sarcasm could hurt someone, like the basic shit that most people already knew. And then after 4 years in, I was getting to new territory of, I haven't found this in a book before. But when you're 13 years in or 14 years in, I don't know that there's going to even be that much novel.
But you also will regress, I'm sure. You know what I mean? Like there's in the same way that like when your cells replicate, like they copy things incorrectly and get a little bit older. I know that that's happening within me to a degree because I'm not sharpening it against real world encounters in the same way that I was.
Sure. I also think as you get, you start to answer questions that aren't even helpful to answer.
That's so like, how I feel.
If you're starting to play basketball, for instance, you're like, oh, we're going to go through a tutorial. You don't need to ask the MVP of the NBA, Nikola Jokic, what do you do when you Eurostep and then you pump fake and they bite on the pump fake and now you have to do a reverse? Like, how much spin do you put on the ball? It's like, yeah, let's not worry about that. Let's worry about how to do a Eurostep. And so there's a sense of like, yeah, at one point we wrote an article on how to date multiple people at once. And it, no one cared because that's not the question they were asking. They were asking, how do I get this one person I like to like me? And so I don't know. Even if you had the bug, I don't know how much new stuff you would be discovering today versus just relearning a lesson you learned 5 years ago.
Well, I think there was new stuff. For instance, like I think I could learn. There was always areas where I wasn't the perfect person, obviously, but like I have friends that even at my peak were better storytellers than me. Like I could break down how to tell a story, but it was not an element of charisma that I leaned on as heavily as other friends of ours who were just storytelling gene people. Like Tom Holland always wants to tell a story, and there's other people out there. I would lean more in the realm of joking, building fake worlds, and then values.
Yeah, improv, sort of more improv comedy.
More improv and then more values. And so I could, you know, I could be like, oh, I'm going to go back and I am going to make sure that not only do I recognize the storytelling skills, which I can see and break down, but I internalize them. And maybe I learned something that I didn't know about the internalization of those skills.
Yeah, I guess the question is, so like the motive initially wasn't to master charisma.
I know, this is...
It was an outcome. It was to improve your dating life, get friends, and like, I don't want to put you on blast, but you have an enviable dating life. You don't lack for friends. So I don't know, like, to what end to try to get your 10 out of 10 storytelling when you can just rely on improv and value connection.
Well, that is the value, and that's the positive in my life. And also the, I just am trying to recognize, like, I think you are still, and I can still make videos from memory that have value to an audience. But
sorry, but what I'm saying is you can also just lean on your strengths for, like, if you don't, like, if you
mean personally.
No, no. In content, if you say, listen, I don't know how to answer a question that audiences have asked, right? Like how to be charismatic on a Zoom call. I would have to study it and I'd have to go out in my own life.
This is a great example.
So I won't make a video on that, but I'll make a video on something else that I do feel like I have, I don't know what to say, topic mastery
on. And so just to underscore what you've said, how to be charismatic on a Zoom call. I've never had a problem on a Zoom call. I've never been the guy who, you know, was on Zoom masturbating.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever ruined a friendship. And I'm generally like enjoy myself. And it seems the people that I speak to as well. But I never sat down with the same rigor.
You never studied it.
And was like, these first seconds are a bit awkward when people join. Like, what is the best joining sentence that I've ever heard anyone say? And can I break it down and can I use it myself? So when people are like, can you do a video on how to do a good Zoom call? We've refrained because I just haven't put that effort in. So yes, I can lean on the things, but I guess I feel like I've answered the most important, interesting questions that I also have good answers to in my videos, which is why I stopped.
Sure.
And I'm sure that you're feeling that.
Well, the tough part is to not be repetitive because...
Well, this is what I'm saying. Because you are not... If you were innovating... you would have interesting things to say. Now, it might not be every week, but once a month, you would come across a new thing.
I also think to some extent, there just are core principles that work for everybody. So like, I mean, yeah, you have an NBA player like Sean Marion who shoots funny and it works for him. But for most people, when you're teaching them a jump shot, it's like, you keep your elbow in, you put your feet here. And so it's like, okay, well, if you're breaking down all the best shooters in history, first of all, you probably want to exclude the ones that shoot oddly because it's not useful. And so in that case, every video will have a different person, but the same shooting motion or similar shooting motions.
Well, I guess the analogy would be, okay, so shooting is the most important question in the NBA. And then dribbling is also a really important question. And defending is a really important question. But I think that there are some questions that remain, like how do I recover from a bad first impression? How do I be charismatic on a Zoom call? There are probably a medium-sized list of those still potentially interesting questions that we have not focused on as intently.
Yeah, if I don't know the answer to it, then I won't make a video on it.
Exactly. And so what I'm saying is, I think you could still make videos, and I've made videos that I think were, for me, basic, that for an audience
were really, really useful. Yeah, you've gone to the things you are interested in, like OnlyFans.
Yeah, I went and made an OnlyFans video.
Exactly. Things you have experience with.
I haven't locked back in, for all those who are wondering. Canceled that account. It for me was not interesting. It was interesting the psychology behind it, but as a customer, well, not for me. The thing we were talking about, business and fulfillment and all these kinds of stuff, and I do think that part of the reason we had the success that we had with Charisma on Command is because it was a dual passion. Like it was just all day we thought about it.
Oh, for sure. I wasn't reading those books so I could make videos or teach people. Yes. I was reading those books so that I could personally learn the lessons. Mm-hmm. And then I figured, well, if I've learned this lesson and it's valuable, I should see if it's helpful to other people. But the motive, definitely first and foremost, for consuming all the content, doing all the experiments, was definitely a personal one.
Yes. And so, and I think that is what put us on that.
We studied it for 6 years before we even started teaching it.
Yes. Yes. And that was why when we started making YouTube videos, we had the success that we had so quickly, mm-hmm. I think, is because it was, we spent a lot of time on, you know, the first YouTube video technically took me an hour, but it also took me 6 years and an hour to make.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the next thing, like, and Charisma on Command is doing well and people are still watching the videos, but I do think, you know, we've talked about this, there's a leveling off of interest. And I think even the audience is like, I've heard you talk about charm and confidence and all these things. Whatever comes in my life, and I'm under the impression that I'm going to have to continue to work, is going to have that same level of drive independent of business. Mm-hmm. And I'm just, you know, we've talked about this, trying to be aware of that and trying to open that up. Because Charisma on Command, I don't know how much more innovative content I have for it unless something in my life really changes.
Yeah. Well, you're mostly training the team now, right?
Well, that is interesting to me. So this is a question that I have, and maybe one day I can make a good video. I haven't made it on purpose because I don't think I'm there yet, which is, yeah, how do you effectively train people? And, you know, that's not a widely interested video, but I do think if I did a really good job, it could be one that was good for the audience. But I'm still learning it, right? I'm only 8 months into that, and it took me 6 years to get good at Charisma, and I'm not as good as it at that as I was at Charisma when we started making mm-hmm. videos. So yeah, maybe in 5 years you'll get a how to train the team.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think right now I'm working with someone to help on the writing, actually. So a woman from Cornell, she's a graduate, and we, at least on the video we're working on, we have novel points. They still rely on my past studies, if that makes sense. Like we're not getting to the point where I'm learning new stuff from her Charisma mm-hmm. experience, but at least what she's helping bring in a fresh perspective. Mm. And so there's like a novel point on gesticulating that I know from my experience out in the world trying to be charismatic, but it just hadn't occurred to me to share based on what I see. Because I think when I watch, I go to the stuff I find most impactful. And so she brought a point to me, and I was like, oh, this is actually, yeah, this is legit. This will work, and it's helpful. And so I think it'll help the videos at least be a little bit fresh. Yeah,
well, I think that's good. And then maybe that's one way to spice it up. Not that spicing it up is the point. I think the point is, I was just thinking, you know, how do you have, this wasn't the question clearly and clarified in my mind, but as I think about it, it's like, how do you be secure in the long term? Mm-hmm. And in the fortunate position that I'm in, it's like, continue to harness the fact that your brain works on things all the time, mm-hmm. and like just like an engine, like channel that in a particular direction. So we talked, you know, we're doing a lot of D&D. I don't know how long that's going to last. And this podcast is a result of the things that I noodle on over the course of the week.
Sure.
But, you know, between you and I, just keep thinking about that question and see what comes up, because it just might not be Charisma forever.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, so it's, I don't know if you want to talk about it on air or sure. not. So I was thinking about this in the realm of D&D, because we were playing D&D, it's super fun, but there's Critical Role out there, and Critical Role is not the only one. There's actually tons of people that saw the success of Critical Role, and we are not first movers by any stretch. And so I was like, oh man, we can't do this. Like, not only are we not Critical Role, we're not even one of the first 100 different groups that have tried this. Mm-hmm. But that's not so dissimilar from when we started Charisma. We were the first people to do Charisma, but people were doing dating coaching, negotiation coaching. There were multi-million dollar businesses in the area-ish of what we were doing.
It took us 2 or 3 years to get to Charisma. Like, we had to float around that.
Yeah, what are we going to teach? We're going to teach promotions. We're going to teach negotiations. Yeah, we're going to teach dating. Like, it was, but so my takeaway was, okay, well, how do we succeed then in the face of going up two dudes with no business skills going up against multi-million dollar organizations was not just novel content, but a novel presentation mm-hmm. on a relatively new platform. And so I think if we were going to do,
it was 8 years old.
Yes, but I don't think that Charisma people had massive success on YouTube yet.
Yes. So it was new. So the first thing you said, like a new angle for the space that you were
on. So one was there wasn't a lot of Charisma topics on YouTube. And yep. Two was the Charisma breakdown was mm-hmm. not big. It was a lot of talking heads. It was a lot of people sitting in front of
the format was very different. Yeah.
And so I was thinking, if we do become people that support our lifestyle through something related to D&D, it will probably not look like playing on YouTube with cameras in our faces. It's just not how Charisma on Command succeeded. We didn't just copy the people that were doing it well. And we're also not voice actors. We have less experience. So I think, yeah, if we're going to be successful, it's going to be maybe not even on YouTube, maybe on a new platform. But if it is, it'll be presented in a new way. Mm-hmm. So it could be taking a 4-hour session and turning it into a 20-minute animated, much more interesting, tighter thing that is based on our D&D sessions, but really involves recording the session and sending it to an animator and sending it to a story writer. And that was my thought. I was like, if we're going to be successful, it's actually not going to look like Critical Role.
Yes.
Because that's not how we were successful, Charisma on Command.
And, well, the good news, and here's the what we did, we didn't lean into too heavily, was the charisma breakdown got attention to our channel. Then I was able to make videos with my face on them that would have never done well where did they come first, that some of them have millions of views.
Sure.
So you could point back to the original 4-hour session if you care to, but I agree.
Well, I was just thinking,
you're not going to capture attention with that six people around a table rolling dice.
And even to make it interesting to other people, I see other people who want to be entrepreneurs. They want to be running Charisma on Command. And what they do is they make a copycat that looks exactly the same, that is in the same format, that just tries to closely resemble the person that they're trying to be like. And I've not ever seen that work. What works is doing something that person you admire hasn't done yet.
Yeah, go to TikTok and do the 60-second thing, you know, blank in 60 seconds. I don't know. That's one way to do it. Mm-hmm. And then you'll have a TikTok audience, which...
Yeah, if you want to be the next PewDiePie, it's not going to be when you and PewDiePie release the same video with the same topic and the same editing and
it's
the same format.
It's not Let's Plays on YouTube where you scream loudly at scary stuff. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's
not, or it's not even looking at his... Today's video is probably not that, but it's not looking at meme review and then doing a meme review. Mm-hmm. You know, you can take the high level, oh, what does PewDiePie do? He finds things that he finds entertaining and presents them to his audience. Okay, so I'm going to find things I find entertaining. I'll be an aggregator of entertaining content. But you're going to have to present it in a way that people on YouTube who are fans of PewDiePie haven't seen. Because if it looks exactly like his, they'll just go watch his. So yeah, that was my only thought. It's like, it's not going to be by buying a really expensive set that looks exactly like Critical Roles and sitting down and playing the exact same length game with someone that sounds exactly like Matt Mercer. We could. It just wouldn't be successful. And then 100 people have tried it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was my only thought.
Yes, that we would need to mix up the format. And more than that, the underlying thing that we've seen with success in our friends that have been successful, the difference between it's not working and it is working in every one of our friends, which I would say are above average intelligence, but some of them are not super gifted, is persistence over time. And that's not in the same business. It can be in like related things or bouncing over. You're a fitness trainer, and then our friends became more into jump rope, and like that jump rope angle is what really worked for them. So it would also have to be something that you reasonably thought that not, am I just going to try to craft a new format? I'm also willing to stick this for 2 years while
If this doesn't make money for 24 months.
And that's, you know, that's why we did this podcast. It was like, if this doesn't make money,
we can at least talk to each other.
I'll talk to you once a week and do it. So that's obviously, you know, interesting to you and I, but if it does make sense, if you're out there as an audience member, I've seen that there's two kinds of people. I do have friends that, God bless them, for whatever reason, they can get inspired by the idea of building something and making money. And it doesn't...
I thought you were just saying building something because they love money.
Yeah. That's like the idea that they could earn a lot of money is enough to motivate them consistently for years. Mm-hmm. And they seem good with it. And I am not built that way, man. Like if my brain doesn't naturally gravitate towards something, I guess I have horrible discipline is really what it is. So if you're like me...
Well, in ways. I mean, you did make a video once a week for 3 years. That requires discipline.
Sure. So it's not that I have horrible discipline.
I never got on your case, and you rarely missed, and you did hundreds of them. So there's discipline in there. It's more like you... How would I describe it? Don't want to do work that you find disinteresting.
Yes. And I will, but I will. But there's always like some sort of combustion going on in my head. And it's not always useful to any people. In fact, it's probably not useful to me 99% of the time. Mm-hmm. It just runs all day. So don't worry, I'll never meditate because this is my power. But yeah, I need to, my success has only ever come from harnessing that uncontrollable interest, which has set itself on things that usually appear quite useless from a business perspective. But weirdly enough, even though it appears useless, after 3 years, eventually you find a crack. And you're like, what if we made a video about a guy talking on a talk show and broke down the five things that he did that made the audience laugh. Yeah, like, yeah. That is such a weird thing to have done.
And it started with, how do I get this girl in college to like me?
Yes, yes. Why does everyone listen to that friend and not to me?
Yeah.
Were the original questions.
I just told that joke 30 seconds ago and no one heard me. And now this guy stole it and got a big laugh.
Yeah. Well, this is something I wanted to say to you. And not that you have to do it, but in terms of new content, and it doesn't have to be charisma related necessarily, but there is sometimes, if you have questions and that are at all related to people that you want answered, like the OnlyFans one is the most recent example of mine, I would just encourage you to do it. I don't know to what degree they appear in your head as clarified questions, but I'm sure they're there. You just might not have noticed some of them.
Why does everyone play League of Legends, even though no one seems to like playing League of Legends?
That could be super interesting, man. Yeah. That could be super interesting.
I don't know
anyone
that says that they enjoy it,
but
I know a lot of people that play it often.
So I could help you with the title there, but there's a video there that is interesting.
I don't know the answer, is the thing.
That is how you make a good video. Because you know why I don't know the answer? Because nobody else knows. And so your video will be the only one with even a reasonable attempt at the answer. So that could be a good video. And that was, I don't know that OnlyFans like changed our business, but it was, I think, a solid video. And
it's just easier to, so for instance, in this next video that's releasing, I just did the absolute easiest ways to get a laugh.
Yeah, the surprising psychology of horrible games or surprising
psychology. But here's what I'm saying. So to do that video, I would have to actually do it. Like tens of hours of research.
Yes.
In this other video, I'll just spoil one of the points. I talk about the wordless walk-off as an incredibly easy way to get a laugh. And the reason I know that works is because I've done it probably in my life 500 times in a variety of situations. And as soon as I saw someone do it on a talk show, I went, I know this works. Mm-hmm. I've done this to get attention at bars. I've done this while flirting. This is a great thing. And I know it because I spent 10 years doing it. Mm-hmm. And so when I'm making that point, I'm just, as soon as I see it, I go, I know what this is, and I've already tried it 100 times. I have no hypotheses left. I've asked all my hypotheses. And for this,
you have to
why
down.
Is League of Legends so unenjoyable, but people keep going back to it, I would be like, all right, well, I don't know the answer. So that's the benefit of the back catalog of content. It's like, I've done this wordless walk-off 500 times.
Yeah. For sure. From a creation perspective, it's easier. It's definitely easier. No doubt.
Yeah, I would have to actually start from scratch instead of starting with 13 years of asking myself the question already.
You'd have to talk to people and you'd have to ask yourself the question when you were going back. And you're like, am I happy?
Yeah.
And you'd be like, no, why won't I stop? I don't get it. Not that you have to make any of those videos, but there might be some that you're interested in. I don't know. What is an example? There could be a ton of things that you are interested in. Questions like, how do I be charismatic on a Zoom meeting? You don't care. How to know if my partner's right for me? Maybe you care. How does one know if their partner is right for them? How to carry a spark years into a relationship? Like something like that. That is potentially interesting. And I'm not saying you have to do this, but here's
the weird part about, so like, okay, a video, how to know if your partner's right for you. I would love to know the answer to that question.
Yeah.
But I don't think I am qualified after a month of research even to know the answer to that question.
I agree. But you might know more considerably than the audience. And the video can be like, you can acknowledge, be like, even with the best case, you're probably one. What I realize is the partners themselves are always blind. they have no idea. And the experts are only right 85% of the time.
Oh, yeah. I'm just circling back to like Craig Ferguson, how to build chemistry in a conversation. I'm positive that that's good information because I have had a lot of conversations with women and I've coached guys on how to help improve their dating life. And it's like, this stuff is good. And I could make a video on how to know if your partner's right for you and then
feel it was not good enough.
Go through a breakup in 6 months and be like, I am an idiot. Then, like, I feel like it's like you'd have to be married for 20 years to make that video.
Oh, no, you don't. You could be with a partner that is not right for you. And that can be part of the video. Is you go like, one of the things that I realized is everybody thinks that their partner is right for them. So you can't trust yourself. I think that's point number one, to be clear, is your partner right for you? Most relationships fail. Most people aren't planning on them failing. Therefore, they are not good people to ask. But you could delete the video if you felt it was that bad.
I could do
bad.
A how to know if your partner is wrong for you video.
Sure.
Because I've had partners that are wrong for me.
Sure, yeah.
And I did that. That was my 90-day fiance video.
Yes. I guess I didn't realize that this was going to be a thing for you, but you can delete the video if you're wrong. You can do your best guess. Like, I know you want to be an expert in it, but there's a degree to which...
I thought we never deleted videos.
We usually don't, but...
I still got a video up there saying Conor McGregor has a chance to beat Floyd Mayweather. I left that up there for posterity.
You can delete it. Well,
it's wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's mostly about visualization. It's just poorly titled.
Yes, it was poorly titled. Yeah, and again, I think you could wisely couch your things and be like, hey, I'm still exploring this. This is my best takeaways after X, Y, and Z. And it can exist as a time capsule of a thing that, you know, was, oh my God, that was so goofy. If I go back and look at my old videos, not that they're not obviously wrong, but like we've talked about, the underlying philosophy in so many of them, and that which was on our sales page, is your relationships in life are everything. And I state that when available. And I just no longer believe like that foundational piece. That's okay.
Unless you expand it to yourself.
Yes. Unless you say, oh, it's my self relationship that is also included in that. And then I go, haha, I tricked you. Relationships are.
Well, I think that's kind of the point, right? It's to get the confidence and the internal self love and then also the external results. That's also why we have emotional mastery.
I don't think that was what I was thinking at the time. And I don't think that was what the people who were listening, because it was like, your relationships are everything. If your boss likes you, if your girlfriend likes you, and if your friends like you. I wasn't like, if the different parts of your personality that make up your core self are all in concert.
That's why you made emotional mastery.
Exactly.
It's for after you go through Charisma University.
It's like a constitution, man. It's a growing document, all right? It doesn't have to be perfect the first time. You make amendments, you go back. And again, you don't have to do any of this, but I was just, you had mentioned, I was thinking about my inability to make innovative videos in the space and was thinking, how could I make innovative videos and when have I? And that, for me, the most recent one was probably either the Jordan Peterson one, which for me was built off the Sam Harris cognitive dissonance clip because I was interested, and the OnlyFans one.
Was Sam Harris?
It was Sam Harris talking to Ben Affleck and the cognitive dissonance piece. And so I was interested in the signs of cognitive dissonance, and I did not know them all. Mm. I still don't know them all, but I wanted to find several that I could include in the video. And so I was looking for those cognitive dissonance clips and like studying Kathy Newman's face and studying Ben Affleck twitching in that interview and going like, how is it happening? What is happening?
Yeah,
like,
why did you have an interest sparked in cognitive dissonance?
I thought that clip was so interesting, as Sam Harris basically says, like, you know, there's this, it's funny. He just says, there's this thing that happens anytime you criticize Islam, people will accuse you of being racist. Now, Islam is a doctrine, and it has specific tenets, and that is not to say that the people who practice it. And Ben goes, oh, so what you're saying is that people are all, that a billion people are? And he's just like, I don't know how I could have prefaced this more gently. And also that Ben Affleck walked away feeling like
he won,
vindicated. Yeah. It was.
I think the internet also vindicated him in the short term, didn't they? There's a lot of stuff written about how he came off well in that conversation. Listen,
This is a Bill Maher interview. The most reasonable criticism of Sam Harris that I've heard is that the polls that he uses to say, at one point he says, look, there's Pew and Gallup research polls that when you ask X percent of British Muslims, they're in favor of Sharia law, they're in favor of this. The most reasonable criticism is that those polls are poorly worded and that they are not actually driving at what people say, but that's not what Ben Affleck, that's not the criticism that Ben Affleck gives. He just goes, this is so obviously racist, because it's just hurting his head to be confronted with information that doesn't.
Yeah, so I was going through a rough time in his life.
Yes. And I'm not saying Ben Affleck's a bad guy. It was just, wow, like, look at this cognitive dissonance set in. The Kathy Newman one. And there were several of them that were in that video. Basically, what I got to, it is, cognitive dissonance is really, it's an interesting thing, but it's so, I had a greater degree of empathy for it. Because basically what happens is you build up beliefs over the course of your life, but you forget the data that led to those. And sometimes that could be really well-founded data, but you just don't have perfect recall. And then you're in a conversation and somebody cites a Gallup research poll that just doesn't sit right with you, but there's nothing that you can say to be like, let me look at those numbers. Like, is there selection bias in these samples? Like, were these British Muslims that actually, you have no way to, and you don't have the logical training to break down exactly what you wouldn't trust in that thing. So you just, you just get really upset at the other person because you feel like you're being attacked for what you believe and you can't find the supports for your beliefs. You're looking around your like mental cave, you're like, why do I believe this thing? I can't. This guy's a monster. I know why. Because you're a monster and you're wrong, and I'm gonna leave right now because you're a horrible person. I have to go. So and there's times when cognitive dissonance, somebody just cites a bullshit statistic at you. And your cognitive dissonance is actually doing good work, but you cannot find the reason that their stuff is bullshit. So anyways, do you want to do some questions? And then
yeah, you have to leave for a flight in 45 minutes, right?
Yes. Well, not leave. I have to go downstairs and pack and then run out the door. So
do we have time for questions?
Yeah.
You just want to go straight to Patreon?
Well, let's do it. It's, I will try to leave here in about 40-ish minutes. So you tell me how we want to do them. We can do it.
I think I'll just save these questions for next week then.
Okay. Well,
we can go straight to Patreon, you're saying?
Yeah, we'll double up next week.
Okay, guys, if you want to see the rest of these questions, we'll have 40 minutes today. And then when I'm back, it should be a little bit easier. I don't know if you have travel coming up, but we can see.
I do. I'm going to the Dominican Republic for a wedding.
All right. Well, we'll figure it out. At some point, we'll crank these out and get you guys a little bit longer stuff.
What day is it? Yeah, we're recording on a Wednesday.
Yeah.
We're even recording on the wrong day.
I know. So if you guys want to see the answer to these questions, if you want to see more, join us on our Patreon. Otherwise, see you next time. Peace.